Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. This is Yaakov Katz and joined by Lahav Harko. And Lahav, you have a lot to say about Ukrainian President Zelensky's speech this week to the Knesset, right? You didn't like some of his comparisons. You didn't like some of his remarks. The final solution, the Holocaust.
Righteous among the nations.
Righteous among
that
the nations.
That really
got you over the top?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, can I just say that my heart goes out to him? Obviously, I think he's and you wrote this nicely. I think you said, you know, he continued his campaign. He tailored his remarks to the audience that was listening to him. But he might have gone over the top with Israel or crossed the line.
I think he just didn't understand Israel, or he's getting bad advice. Either he thinks he understands Israel because he's from a Jewish background, or he got bad advice.
A mistake
about
that
Israel.
Many other people have made in the past. Right?
Right. I have a huge amount of respect for him. I think the whole world does. Respect and admiration for him. I mean, he's overall conducting himself in a way that
is amazing.
Right. Totally admirable. I think in this speech, the fact that it was so heavily focused on comparing the situation to the Holocaust, as opposed to World War II, by the way, because there are, I think, fair comparisons to be made to World War II, the war, right? Mm-hmm. Like Hitler, for example, felt that he had carte blanche to go into areas where there were large German-speaking populations. He felt that was his right.
And just invade, right?
Right, and Putin's kind of doing that to Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. But the comparisons to the Holocaust were too great. You know, I don't think that Putin is planning genocide of the Ukrainian people, right? It's not he's planning something horrible, but it's not that. And not every terrible war is the Holocaust. And then he ended his speech by saying that, you know, 80 years ago, Ukrainian righteous among the nations made their decision, and now Israel needs to make its decision and live with its decision, right? There's something like 2,600 Ukrainian righteous among the nations registered in Yad Vashem, and I looked it up, and there are...
How many Jews did they save?
I don't know.
Right, probably, so let's say a few thousand, but we do know that about 1.5 million Jews were killed in Ukraine.
Correct.
Many of them by Ukrainians during the Holocaust.
But, you know, but something like 100,000 Ukrainians like volunteered to help the Nazis.
Right. No, but here's the thing that, you know, again, my heart goes out to him. Obviously, a leader who's in duress. His country's being hammered by the Russians. People are dying, innocent civilians. His military is not going to be able to stop them. He's in a bad place. But I don't know that we have to jump every time. I'm not saying, you know, ministers did, right? The Prime Minister of Israel had responded and said, you can't compare between the Holocaust and Ukraine. I just don't know that every single time someone mentions the Holocaust, we have to go back and say, but it's not the Holocaust.
No, but Bennett didn't jump, right? He was speaking at a conference and he was asked the question. Before that, when he gave a speech like an hour before that conference, he didn't say anything about the Holocaust. He didn't even directly say anything about the speech. He just said that we in Israel can be very proud of the massive humanitarian aid that we're sending to Ukraine.
Which was a field hospital that was sent there this week also.
He was sending off the staff, 60 people, who are going to run a field hospital in Ukraine, and we're the only country who's done that so far.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was Bennett's
message.
In
Ukrainian territory, across the border,
correct.
In Ukraine.
Correct. And that was Bennett's message, that we should be proud of what we did. Sort of, you know, and it was very clearly in response to Zelensky saying, we're not doing enough. You know, he's saying, no, we are doing this, and this is a great thing, even if it's not exactly what you're asking for. Then when he was asked about the Holocaust, he said, you know, this is a leader who's fighting for his life. I personally think nothing is comparable to the Holocaust.
Right.
So I think as the prime minister and as someone who's trying to maintain some level of like diplomatic, you know, the ability to talk to Zelensky and Putin at the same time, I think that was appropriate.
Zelensky made some comments about that kind of dance that Bennett has been doing over the last couple of weeks of talking both with Zelensky and with Putin. He said, it's good to mediate, right? I might be paraphrasing here, but you can't mediate between good and evil.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to take away from that and to understand about the Bennett mediation, which we were led to believe was the most critical, most important, and was actually making progress?
So Zelensky himself is doing a dance, right? And it's like, I am not sure what his tactic is here, and you could tell me if you have an opinion on it, but Zelensky was the one to begin with who asked Israel to mediate. He started asking over a year ago when Netanyahu was still prime minister, right? And throughout this war, he wanted Bennett to mediate and said Bennett's not doing enough to mediate. Mm-hmm. Then Bennett jumped into it and really started taking it seriously, and then you start hearing from all these different officials that they don't like the way Bennett's mediating, right? And so, which is, I feel like this is like Ukraine and Israel have this in common, I feel like. But anyway, Zelensky then in his speech says, right, you can't mediate between good and evil. Like, why are you mediating but not taking a side?
Right.
But then a few hours after that, he puts a message on his Telegram where he says, we really appreciate the mediation efforts very much, and we think that Jerusalem would be a good place for talks.
Which might have come as pressure after the call, after the talk. Someone in Bennett's office might have reached out to someone in his office, total speculation maybe, on my part, and said, hey, if you want this to keep up, why are you raining on, you know, our efforts?
Yeah, it could be. He could have seen that the reaction in Israel was not what he thought it would be, because really there were a lot of politicians who were not happy about the Holocaust comparisons, and I think that really overshadowed the rest of the speech, his plea for weapons, his plea for, you know, helping people of Ukraine, which Israel is helping the people of Ukraine but not giving weapons.
But Israel isn't giving weapons. He did repeat the Iron Dome situation, which we were unclear whether it was real or not to begin with, but based on what he said, it does seem that Ukraine actually asked for Iron Dome. Not that I'm sure, we spoke about this, right? What Iron Dome exactly would be able to do.
Right, and 2 weeks ago the ambassador said that Iron Dome is not, like, relevant to this conflict. So it's very strange. It's as if, like, he was just mentioning it because it's the brand name.
Because it's a brand, it's an Israeli brand. But we know, I mean, Israel's not giving weapons. Israel's not taking a clear stand, but it kind of is, right? I mean, Yair Lapid says at every possible opportunity that we condemn Russia, right?
Yeah.
Bennett doesn't, but Lapid does.
But Bennett's the one who's also meeting with
Putin. But Bennett's the one who's also mediating
with
Putin.
By the way, you know what Bennett also said today? So he was asked at this conference, it's a conference on Yediot Ahronot, if Putin seems to be, like, gone crazy, you know, in steroid rage or in has Parkinson's,
right,
or
I've
all these
the
like weird rumors.
Reports, right.
I've also seen rumors that he's on steroids because he's like kind of puffy looking.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and so Bennett said that if from what he saw, he didn't, there's no indication of any of those things, which seems right to me. I mean, like,
I love those questions.
You know, too. Like, you what?
like, he's now a medical expert also. Yeah. But, I mean, look.
Well, someone who has serious Parkinson's, you could tell.
You would probably be able to tell that something's going on. That's true. So, Israel's involvement will continue on the humanitarian side. It will continue to give help, provide assistance, field hospital, refugees. It seems like we finally found our way in terms of who's allowed in, who's not allowed in. Ayala Chakaid folded on that.
Mostly, yeah. I mean, anybody who has, like, someone to stay at in Israel can come.
Right.
Pretty much.
Now, as Ukraine is happening, Iran is back in the headlines as well, right?
Yes.
In a big way. I actually wrote a piece this past week, last week, which...
when we, like, double-teamed the government. We both wrote these pieces about why aren't they talking about Iran the last few weeks.
Exactly. You went after them on the IRGC. I went after them on them just not talking at all about anything and how they're being silent and being led by the Americans. And then Friday morning, we put both pieces on the front page. Friday morning... we had the Richie Torres story also on the front page, where Richie Torres is more militant, the Democratic congressman from
the Bronx,
from the Bronx, more militant than Israel's own leaders. And then Friday morning, Bennett and Lapid go out swinging with a harsh statement. I would say possibly the harshest yet by this government about the Biden administration. Because of what?
Well, it really depends who you ask. I'll tell you, I spoke to a source very close to Lapid, and I told you about this. And he was like, oh, you at JPost, you guys looked so foolish because we made the statement hours after that was your front page. And I said, no, the opposite is true. I think that we had our finger of the pulse of what is actually going on and what's being discussed in the halls
of
government.
Just in parentheses, just about that comment that person made.
Yeah.
I mean, it played out completely differently publicly. Like, everybody who saw that said, wow, you guys... got them basically to make the statement. I don't know if we did get them or we didn't get them. You know, we could pat ourselves on the back. We don't have to. But I think you are right, is that we hit something. We hit a nerve that clearly something's going on here.
Yeah. Look, I think, and I wrote this in the piece on Friday, that, you know, Bennett, Lapid, and Gantz as a trio sort of deserve credit because they're the ones who brought this whole IRGC thing to light, that the U.S. wants to take the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps off of its list of foreign terrorist organizations. But then after they brought it to light, and it was like in a series of speeches, one of them, like you interviewed Lapid that week at the Conference of Presidents, and there was the Munich Security Conference, and they really put on the pressure. And then suddenly, because of the war in Ukraine, they went quiet. And the fact is that, like, you know, even if there's a war going on, the Vienna talks continue. They've now been on a break for, by the time this comes out, it'll be 2 weeks. You know, the threat still stands. The Iran deal is still on the table. The reason that you know, I've gotten from people surrounding Bennett and Lapid is that they felt that the timing was of the essence, that, you know, that the U.S. was really moving towards agreeing to this.
Why is this where they're making their stand? Iran is about to get the best deal possible. This will pave the way for them to get a nuclear weapon if and when they decide. So keeping the IRGC on the FTO, the Foreign Terrorist Organization list, that's where Israel, like, that's Israel's, that's the hill Israel's going
to
die on?
Well, so there's an element to it that we haven't mentioned yet, which is that it's in exchange for a commitment from Iran to de-escalate in the region and to not attack any Americans. And I think that there's something symbolic there, that America's looking out for itself and not its allies, despite saying all along, oh, we're in talks with our allies and we care about their security concerns. I think that
But the deal itself is, pardon my language, but it's throwing Israel under the bus. It's a deal that's going. So here is where we suddenly say, okay, yeah, they'll be able to retain the highly enriched uranium. They're going to be able to keep their sixth generation centrifuges. They'll be able to keep all the centrifuges and all the facilities and have to shut them down. But the IRGC, that's what we care about.
The logic from Bennett and Lapid is that their whole way of playing this whole Iran talks thing is that they're saying, we're not attacking the Americans so that we can work behind the scenes for our security, right? Because they know the Americans are determined to have an Iran deal, so we need to work hand in hand with the Biden administration so that we are safe and we have guarantees of our security. And this is a betrayal of that, right? This says, even though they were playing nice with the Biden administration, the Biden administration is still going out and not protecting them.
So can I propose another possibility?
Yeah.
And that is that the Iran deal is very difficult to explain to people, right? I think that your average person doesn't fully understand the intricacies of the deal. Not that I don't know that I fully understand all of them, but you know, what exactly the sunset clause is, how it's still going to be in effect, how the deal will, some parts of the restrictions will expire in just less than 3 years, and more, and exactly what they could keep, what they can't keep, how much can they keep, where does some of it go, et cetera. Here is a clear example of something that's it's absolute. It's a bad organization, the IRGC, being taken off a list. And like you said, the Americans said that they would stand by their ally, and here they're clearly not. And that's something that could also come with a political price to Bennett and Lapid, and that's why they had to maybe stand up and say something.
Yeah, could be. Also, you know, Netanyahu has been going on Fox News and putting on videos online in English. I don't think that it's making such huge ripples in Israel.
No, I don't think it has either. No,
but that could be part of it too.
But you know, Lahav, this is something that maybe I'm wrong about, but I spoke with the people in Bennett and Lapid's office also before I wrote my piece over the last couple weeks. And they also made the argument to me, like they've been saying to you, which is, you know, we looked at what Netanyahu did in 2015, went to Congress, fought with Obama, stuck a finger in his eye, didn't stop the deal, ruined relations with the Democrats.
We got UN Resolution 2334.
Right. Why would we want to do that again? Granted, I don't think that that's what we should do either. But between that and staying silent, there is some room in the middle. There's a spectrum of things that we could potentially do. But what I also argue is with the notion that by staying quiet now, it'll help us work better with them later. If they see that us as a country don't stand up for an issue that has the potential to be an existential threat to our people, to the state of Israel, then why would they take us seriously the day after? They'll look at us and they'll be like, look, we could run over these guys on the most important issue that touches at the most important core security and existence of the state of Israel. And there they didn't fight with us. So now we could just keep doing whatever we want.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you.
I don't know if it's good policy.
Netanyahu's approach ultimately did not work. And Bennett's approach does not appear to be working either.
Oi. One big oi.
Yes. Well, you know what Bennett said in his conference also? He said that people should be bogged down in anxiety. Israel is taking care of the problem. So if that's comforting to you.
For some reason, it's not. Lahav, next week, you and I are going to be maybe recording from London?
Yes.
Right. The Jerusalem Post, to our listeners, you should know, and especially those in the UK, we are putting together an international conference at the Tottenham Hotspurs Stadium. I hope I pronounced that right.
Tottenham. It's like the Hebrew. You don't pronounce the H.
You don't pronounce the H. I am an ignorant person when it comes to soccer, a.k.a. football. But I've been reading up a lot about it. But we have a really all-star cast who's coming to our conference. We have Avigdor Lieberman, the finance minister, Ayelet Shaked, who's really been in the news as the interior minister talking about refugees, and we'll be discussing with her about Iran. We have Yoaz Hendel, who you'll be interviewing on stage, Israel's communications minister and one of the more interesting politicians. And all of the commissioners who are fighting anti-Semitism around the world. So we have Aaron Kayak, who's from the Biden administration's envoy, Katharina von Schnurben, who is the EU's representative to the fight against anti-Semitism, Lord John Mann from the UK, and Dr. Felix Klein from Germany. Lots of interesting people. You will be able to catch this on Thursday, March 31st, on the Jerusalem Post website live. So our readers, listeners should be able to watch it. And if you are in the UK, there's links going around that you could potentially register and hopefully find a secure spot at the conference, or if you want to fly to London for it. So I guess we'll be talking next week from London, and maybe before the conference, but there will be news. So on this week's podcast, though, who's our guest?
So we have Rabbi Natan Slifkin. He is often nicknamed the Zoo Rabbi. But before we get to his nickname, we brought him on the show to talk about Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky.
Right.
One of the leading rabbis of the Haredi world, if not the leading rabbi, especially among what are called Lithuanian Haredim, the non-Hasidic Haredim. He passed away.
On Friday.
Yeah, on Friday.
Right before Shabbat.
Yeah. And his funeral was on 94
Sunday. 94
years old. About 500,000 Israelis went to his funeral, effectively shutting down the center of the country.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah, truly, truly incredible how much respect was shown to him.
Now, the cover of every newspaper, every news, every TV station was live feed from this funeral. I mean, I don't remember a funeral like that. I mean,
half a million people. That's like 5% of the country or something.
I was wondering, I should have looked this up, but I was wondering, I was here in high school when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, and the high school took us in Jerusalem. We I think his coffin laid in state.
Right? Outside the Knesset.
Yeah, outside the Knesset. And we kind of filed by
I was at Sharon and Shamir because I was covering the Knesset.
Hundreds of thousands of people, I want to say, were there. Yeah. I wonder how many, but that was such tragic, traumatic circumstances. This wasn't. I mean, the guy was 94, right? Lived a pretty long life and died of old age. But still, he represented and symbolized something for his followers. And that's admirable.
Right. So we brought in Rabbi Natan Slifkin to talk about who Rabbi Kanievsky was, what he represents to the Haredi community.
What does his passing mean for the future of the Haredi community?
Yes, and their Torah sages.
And we talked to him about his books that have been banned, science, religion.
Right. So Rabbi Slifkin's known.
He's been put in cherem in the past.
Rabbi Slifkin's known as the Zoo Rabbi because he has written a lot about science and specifically about animals. His books have been banned because he talks about things like evolution and other.
And dinosaurs, apparently. I had to ask him, what's the problem with talking about dinosaurs with Haredim? But apparently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, a lot of religious schools don't talk about evolution either because it sort of seems to contradict the idea of God creating man.
In my day school in Chicago, we weren't taught evolution, but we were taught about dinosaurs. I mean, you can't ignore dinosaurs existed.
I went to a modern Orthodox school that was very modern. So I was taught about all of these
things. You were taught about all these things.
But, I know my husband didn't learn about these things and he sort of came to them on his own. And that's how I heard about Rabbi Slifkin because my husband finds these things very interesting. And he also has the Biblical Museum of Natural History in Beit Shemesh, which is very interesting. We talk about that as well.
You should definitely be checking out that place if you're coming to Israel over Pesach or this summer, or you live here and you haven't been there like neither of us have been there. So we have where to take our kids.
Yes, I've been meaning to.
And we all shall. So here we go.
This week, we're welcoming to the podcast Rabbi Natan Slifkin, the director of the Biblical Museum of Natural History in Beit Shemesh, to talk about Rav Chaim Kanievsky of blessed memory, who passed away this week, and his role in the Haredi world and in Judaism writ large. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Can you tell us who was Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky?
It's an interesting question, because a lot of people would answer that question incorrectly. There's a lot of confusion about as to who he was and who he wasn't. He was one of the, if not the greatest Torah scholar in the world. He has phenomenal dedication. He learned 17 hours a day. Just the perfect example of the person sitting and learning, and every topic of Torah knowledge. Of course, all from a unique Lithuanian mystical perspective, but from that perspective, he covered really, you know, every aspect of Torah. You know, in my own work, I used his writings and discussing the kosher status of locusts. You know, a bit of an arcane topic, but he wrote on everything. So that's who he really was. You know, he wasn't a head of an institution or anything like that. He just was somebody who learned. But because of his, you know, because his reputation grew as somebody who was just had this incredible selfless dedication to learning Torah. So people asked him questions, and he was able to answer, and he diligently answered tens of thousands of questions that poured in year after year. And then he became something else. He became kind of an icon in the Haredi world.
What do you make, though, of, you know, he was part of, like you described, the Litaim, right? The Lithuanian class or sect of Haredi ultra-Orthodox Judaism, unlike the Hasidim. I don't want to say, you know, about less spiritual, but a bit less into the idea of following a single leader and turning that leader into something of like a ruler, kind of like the Admor or the Rebbe would be for a Hasidic sect. But that is exactly what they did to Rabbi Kanievsky, right? They made him into someone who could give brachot and blessings to people, someone who could, you know, you come in, you kiss his hand, which is was never seen before in these types of communities. Where did that come from?
Correct. He was turned into this kind of quasi-Hasidic Rebbe. You know, in my blog, Rationalist Judaism, I wrote a post about this called Three Funerals. So there were actually three quite separate funerals that took place yesterday. There was one for the real Rav Chaim, you know, the tremendous Torah scholar, the selfless person, the person who eschewed any, you know, comforts or power or anything like that, just because he wanted to just learn Torah. That was the real Rav Chaim, and, you know, the great loss with his being gone. Then there's this magical supernatural figure, you know, who was believed to have supernatural knowledge of everything going on in the world and can bless things and impart tremendous power to things. And then there was the funeral for the opportunity, the small number of people who created that second persona and who manipulated it for power and money.
I saw one post that you had written earlier about specifically about his grandson, who built apparently a nice house with money, maybe from his that he was able to somehow get out of managing his grandfather?
Yes, it's difficult to say exactly how that happened, but whereas Rav Chaim lived in a very simple, small apartment, his grandson built a very nice home. His grandson does not have any formal job that I know of, but he manages Rav Chaim Kanievsky, and it's been known for a while that you know, it's a business, you know? If you want to have influence in the Haredi world, you want to have Rav Chaim's name on things.
And this sort of came to a head at the beginning of the pandemic, where it seemed that the proclamations about what the Haredi community should be doing, whether they should be closing their schools, whether they should be gathering or not, seemed to be very much filtered through the grandson. What did you think? What did that do to his reputation?
Well, it was interesting. You know, there were people criticizing Rav Chaim Kanievsky for, you know, a lot of those initial statements about not closing schools and saying he was a bad leader. But the truth is, I feel his criticisms were a bit unfair. You know, he wasn't a bad leader. He wasn't a good leader. He wasn't a leader. He wasn't a leader to begin with. He was a scholar. You know, there's different types of rabbis. There's different types of roles that rabbis play. You've got a synagogue rabbi. You've got a Rosh Yeshiva. You've got a community activist. You know, you've got a halachic ruler. Rav Chaim Kanievsky was the Torah scholar. He was the one who sat and learnt and mastered different areas of Torah. But what happened was that those around him, you know, were able to, present him as a mouthpiece for leadership when he wasn't any kind of leader in the first place. You know, they were just whatever was expedient to them, they would have said in his name, and that was and they realized it backfired. You know, quite early on, I think they realized that the opposition to the COVID restrictions was not good. So then they were able to swiftly turn it around and have Reb Chaim, you know, endorsing the vaccine.
You know, Rabbi Slifkin, Rabbi Dr. Slifkin, if I might say, what's interesting, I think, what's happened, the evolution of these rabbis, right, is that they're also, Reb Chaim Kanievsky, as you mentioned, was always sitting and learning, but he also became something of a political figure. Every Israeli politician went to his house, kissed the ring, so-called, and had that photo taken with the grand rabbi. We saw just when he passed away on Friday, since then, the floodgates opened up on Twitter and Facebook. Every Israeli politician who's ever taken a photo with him shared those photos for the public to see. How I also met with Reb Chaim, and he was a great leader, etc. So he also played a very important political role for the community, right?
Well, I wouldn't phrase it that way. It's not that he played a political role, it's that he was played for a political role. You know, he didn't know what was going on, you know, outside the walls of his apartment. He was only interested in learning Torah. And people would feed him information, and the people around him knew exactly what to feed him to get the results that was wanted. So, you know, he effectively played a political role, but not in any kind of, you know, active initiative in his part.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so people talk about how with the passing of Reb Chaim, it's created a vacuum of leadership. And I think that's a mistake.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to ask you, because there's a lot of talk now about Rabbi Gershon Edelstein, right? How he's now the successor for the 94-year-olds is a 98-year-old rabbi.
Right. So he is somewhat of a leader. In other words, he has had leadership roles. He was the Rosh Hashiva. He was the head of an institution. And in fact, there's a theory that the reason why he was sidelined for Reb Chaim, because Reb Chaim was, it was more possible to, you know, to get Reb Chaim to say what he wanted him to say. Because Reb Chaim wasn't a leader, so he became a more effective political tool. And the whole business is very unfortunate. You know, it's really a lack of respect for who Reb Chaim really was, that that people tried to, you know, to use him in this way.
I'll say, you know, as a kid growing up in Chicago, I don't know if you know this, Lahav, but you grew up in New York and New Jersey. But in Chicago, like, we knew the Stipler, right? The Stipler, that was Reb Chaim's father, was like, I can't say I ever read any of his books, but like, he was one of the big Gedolei Ador, like the great sages of our time, right? And then Reb Chaim Kanievsky, obviously the son, was, you know, the follower of his father, right? It's like a dynasty of huge rabbinic authority.
For sure, it's amazing. But you have to realize there's two different ideas about what rabbinic authority and guidance means. The conventional, and I would say the traditional view, is that, you know, Torah imparts great wisdom, and to the extent that a rabbi has that wisdom, and also to the extent that he is wise in the ways of the world, he is an authority for what goes on in the world. But the modern Haredi mystical idea is the complete opposite, that the more isolated a rabbi is from the world, the more qualified he is to speak about the world. And that's the innovation, that's part of the aspect of the innovation of Das Torah, that the more isolated a rabbi is, the more he knows about what's going on out there.
So who do you think, I mean, we were just said that Rabbi Edelstein is 98 years old, so, you know, may he live to 120, but who? What do you think is sort of coming down the pipeline for the Haredi world when the Gedolim are so much older now? Like, are there figures that will be able to step up instead of them?
It's very hard to say, I would say. You know, that type of old school people who were born in Europe in that generation, you know, that generation is disappearing. And it's difficult to see what type of leaders will emerge. You know, there's a lot of, it's not really the dynamic of leadership and you have in the Haredi world that you have in other communities. So it's very hard to see.
Will that create a crisis though for the community, right? You know, for not necessarily a vacuum, but just a crisis of like, who are the common folk supposed to
right,
look up
to?
Who do they go to for
that's
questions?
That's what's been going on the last few years. I mean, who was guiding the Haredi community during coronavirus?
The guiding was just whatever the rules were, you do the opposite. I say that facetiously.
You know, Reb Chaim was only ever a mouthpiece of what the people around him wanted, you know, to have said. There was no real, you know, leadership going on during coronavirus. So it's very difficult to see. But because he was able to be used that way, so it gave the impression that there's leadership, that there's a leader. So now that that's gone, it'll be interesting to see how things develop. Look, Haredi society is in a state of tremendous flux anyway. Mm-hmm. The changing world that we live in, the impact of technology, it's very hard to predict where it's going. In general, I try not to make any predictions except in hindsight.
So let's move on to you. You have a lot of interesting things going on, and I think our readers might be interested in hearing. You run a very unique natural history museum. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, it's the Biblical Museum of Natural History, and we focus on the animal world of the Bible and of biblical Israel. And it's really part museum, part zoo. There's a lot of interactions with live exotic animals, and people go on a guided tour and learn about the animal world of the Bible. And it's shocking for people to learn that things like crocodiles and hyenas and leopards and lions, these are all part of the biblical landscape, and the animals that are mentioned in the Torah and that have biblical significance.
So is the target audience people who are ultra-Orthodox or even just in general public?
Across the spectrum. In fact, we have an incredibly diverse range of visitors, secular, Dati Leumi, Haredi, Hasidic. In fact, even there's people who won't go to the zoo because the zoo is open on Shabbat, but they'll come to us. And it's a very it's a topic of universal interest. Mm-hmm. Everyone is interested to learn that just over 120 years ago, there were wild crocodiles here. 3,000 years ago, there were hippos here, and what the significance of the hippo was. And people are fascinated to learn that the largest kosher creature is the giraffe and the smallest one is the locust. And everybody enjoys wrapping a 15-foot python around their shoulders. Well, maybe not everyone, but most people.
And apparently, though, it's very difficult to slaughter a giraffe, right? Because
it's challenging, not impossible. No, there's a myth that we don't know where to slaughter it. You know, that's a myth. Anywhere in the neck is fine. But giraffes are a protected species. So practically speaking, it's not something that gets done.
We shouldn't be slaughtering them.
But you've been controversial in the religious world because you have written about and you talk about evolution, which is like a topic that's not covered in Haredi education. So how do you get sort of Haredi crowds to come to your museum?
Right. So, you know, I used to be very much part of the Haredi world, and it was when I was part of the world that I published three books in Torah and science that were banned by major figures in the Haredi world. And that led to my interest in the topic of rabbinic authority. But what I decided to do, you know, when my books were banned, I withdrew from that world. And in the museum, we create a very clear distinction. In other words, we don't have any exhibits on this topic in the museum. There's no exhibits on evolution or dinosaurs or anything like that. You know, I've got the skeleton in my closet, the dinosaur skeleton in my closet, but it's staying in the closet. The museum experience is something that's suitable for everyone. It doesn't contain anything that's...
What's the problem, Rabbi Slifkin, with dinosaurs, though?
Well, they lived millions
of years ago. I mean, they lived billions of years ago. I get that part. But so because of the timeline, it doesn't fit into the 4,000-year history?
Exactly. And then you have to take a creative approach. Well, in my understanding, you know, Rambam, Maimonides also took a non-literal approach to the 6 days of creation. But the Haredi world, you know, they don't want to deal with these kinds of issues at all. It's like a non-starter to even discuss these kinds of topics. So, you know, when books were banned, I withdrew them from the Haredi world. I republished them with a non-Haredi publisher and distributor. And I'm very much separating my work. You know, I have the books and my blog where I discuss these issues regarding to Torah and science, rationalism and sociology. But in the museum, we keep it just about animals in a way that's perfectly suitable for all sectors of society.
What was it in particular about the books that got them banned?
It was really evaluating Torah in light of science, you know, accepting the fact that science has proved certain things, like that the world is extremely old, and that in zoology, that certain things do not exist. There's no mice that grow out of dirt. And then looking at what the Torah and the Talmud says about these things and evaluating these things, and in that light, you know, particularly saying that certain accounts in the Talmud about science, like about mice that grow from dirt and other examples of spontaneous generation, saying that while the sages of the Talmud, you know, they were authoritative in Torah, but when they spoke about science, they were simply repeating what was common knowledge back then, which in some cases was mistaken. And that was a position that was stated by many, many leading authorities over the ages, the Gaonim, Rambam, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, many others. But in the Haredi world, that's a complete non-starter.
Mm-hmm. I want to take you back just for a moment to something you said earlier about how the Haredi community is really undergoing some major changes. And I think you know, if you look at Israeli society, and Reuven Rivlin, the former president, was the one who spoke about the different tribes, right? There's the secular Israelis, the Arabs, the Haredim, the national religious, etc. But this is a tribe within Israel that really is in remarkable shift, right? Whether it's poverty and people trying to break away, more men in the workforce, many more women of the Haredi community in the workforce, more people serving in the IDF. Internet engagement, right? A lot of them have the kosher phone, but they, I think it's what, 50-60% also have a second phone, a smartphone, the non-kosher phone. And their rabbis are dying, right? Because they're old. So where do you see them in 10 years from now? You know, for your average secular Israeli, they looked at those pictures, and I think they were impressed maybe by how 500,000 or however many number of people came out to pay respects to this rabbi. But they also wondered, why aren't they working, and why are they now stopping me from being able to work? Because, right, they shut down the whole center of the country. So where do you see this community going?
It's hard to say. I will say that, you know, some of what's talked about as being change that's happening is slightly exaggerated. You know, yes, there are increasing numbers of Haredim going out to work, but you know, if the average family has 6 kids and now there's 2 kids going out to work, that's still, you know, an exponential increase in the number of people who are not going to work. So, you know, that thing is not changing as fast as it needs to for the viability of the national economy. I think it's the internet that has a huge impression, the free flow of information, the websites, Haredi websites. That's where the real strong signs of change are happening. But how it will play out is very difficult to predict.
Well, Rabbi Dr. Slifkin, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. To our listeners, you got to check out biblicalnaturalhistory.org, where you'll see what looks like a lizard with eyes moving and a tongue sticking out. Pretty cool video. Oh, my God. A chameleon just ate something in front of my eyes. And then now there's an owl. But anyhow, fascinating stuff. Rabbi Slifkin, we thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We are here every week on all the major podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, etc. If you enjoy it, please send it to your friends and family. And we'll be back next week.